on the Spartans on Saturday. DePaul has had a tough schedule, but tonight it gets really difficult after going 1-2 against the 10th, 12th, and 19th ranked teams in the nation. DePaul travels to Connecticut to take on the top-ranked Huskies. DePaul is coming off a 69-62 win over number 19, Pittsburgh. The St. Louis Blues travel to Calgary to take on the Red Hot Flames tonight. Calgary is looking for its third straight victory and 10th in the last 12 games. One of those wins was against a Blues team that has lost 11 of its last 15. And the Chicago Bears have agreed to hire defensive backs coach John Hoke, who spent the last 7 seasons in a similar post with the Houston Texans. Hoke succeeds Stephen Wilkes, who was fired after the Bears went 9-7 and missed the playoffs. Before his Texans stint, Hoke spent 3 seasons as the defensive coordinator and secondary coach at the University of Florida. That's sports.
Programming on AM 580 is made possible in part by a grant from the Thrifty Nichols American Classifieds, distributed each Thursday in over 100 towns in East Central Illinois, on the web at TNOL.com.
Dell has decided to pay nearly $4 million in this country to settle claims that it misled consumers about financing and service offers.
Dell has been by far the largest employer in this friendly, verdant corner of the Emerald Isle ever since the company set up here 18 years ago.
The money will go to reimburse consumers who say they were misled by Dell and to individual states to pay their legal costs. The settlement was announced by Connecticut Attorney General Richard Blumenthal, but multiple states signed on to it. Blumenthal said Dell had been guilty of bait-and-switch tactics. He said Dell had promised 0% financing to customers who nevertheless had to pay high interest rates and fees. State officials also said some consumers had trouble getting warranty service or didn't receive rebates. Dell said yesterday that it was pleased by the prompt and reasonable settlement. A spokesman said the number of consumer complaints represented only a very small percentage of the tens of millions of consumer transactions that Dell was involved with. But the company did agree to provide customers with more information about financing and to fulfill its warranty obligations. Consumers who believe they were misled by Dell are supposed to file claims with their respective states within 90 days. Jim Zeroli, NPR News, New York.
And now another story about Dell. Dell announced it is cutting 2/3 of the workforce at a major factory in Limerick, Ireland. It's moving 1,900 jobs to a shiny new plant in Poland. The move is a shock to the Western Irish city, where Dell was the main employer. It's also a sign that Ireland is losing the cost competitiveness that boosted its economy for decades. NPR's Rob Gifford reports from Limerick.
Dell has been by far the largest employer in this friendly, verdant corner of the Emerald Isle ever since the company set up here 18 years ago. The impact of the job losses here was summed up by Alan English, editor of the local newspaper, The Limerick Leader.
Yeah, the headline in the paper today is the blackest day, and we have 5 further pages of coverage on what is the biggest bad news story to hit our area in a generation.
There are still 1,000 non-manufacturing Dell jobs remaining here, and another 1,300 in sales and marketing in Dublin. But in Limerick, in small coffee shops like the one run by Liz Murphy near to the Dell factory, the layoffs will certainly be felt.
We're just around the corner from Dell. We're just at the entrance to the industrial estate. So I think the loss of jobs is going to have a huge impact on the business here in just, a small coffee shop.
Dell opened its Limerick facility with great fanfare in 1990, right at the start of the boom that led Ireland's economy to be known as the Celtic Tiger. Low corporate tax, government subsidies, and a skilled but relatively cheap labour force led other companies to follow Dell's lead and move their manufacturing bases to Ireland. But Dell's European Vice President, Sean Corkery, said Dell can't make computers in a place that pays $15 an hour when the company could make them in a place that pays $5.
You have to remain cost competitive. It's a very difficult market out there. And as part of our restructuring program to be more cost competitive, we need to be a price leader in the market. And for that, we need to have the right costs. It's in that context we had to make this decision.
Ireland has now become the victim of a policy from which it once benefited, whereby poorer European Union countries could offer subsidies to lure foreign firms. Now, though, the EU Commission says it's investigating the legality of Poland's $66 million grant to lure Dell from Ireland. Stephen Kinsella of the University of Limerick says there could be a silver lining to the closure of the Dell plant.
This is going to be seen as a watershed moment in Irish economic history. This is the moment when we changed from a low-value manufacturing-based service economy, and our focus changed to a high-value innovation-based research and development economy. Painful, but utterly necessary.
More jobs will likely be lost in the short term, says Kinsella, but he adds the Irish government needs to invest even a fraction of the money it spent bailing out Irish banks to help laid-off workers of Dell or other companies to set up their own businesses.
If you give 100 of those people loans and they create 9 more jobs each, you've taken 1,000 people out of the unemployment line. Of those 100 companies, 75 of them are going to fail, 5 of them will be small and medium enterprises, 10 more might be enterprises with 15 to 50 people in them. One of them might be the next Google.
Ireland has proved before that it can reinvent itself. The problem is this time it will have to be done against the looming backdrop of the credit crunch and the global recession. So this time it's likely to be more difficult and to take much longer. Rob Gifford, NPR News, Limerick in Western Ireland.
When President-elect Obama takes office, he takes on important responsibilities, some of which have more to do with the practicalities of life in the White House. Commentator Amy Gaida explains in this week's edition of Legal Issues in the News.
President-elect Obama takes office in just a few days. Or, more formally, the term of 4 years shall commence on the 20th day of January. That's a part of the federal statutes, which often speak with a less giddy voice than ordinary people do. But those federal statutes do more than simply pinpoint the day of the presidential inauguration. They also give us insight into some pretty nice perks that come with the presidency. Of course, there's a decent salary, $400,000 paid by law in monthly installments. I say decent, by the way, because even though the salary has doubled in recent times, it's probably less than Senator Obama would have been making had he kept working at the hotshot Chicago law firm where he met his wife. The president doesn't have to use that salary for incidentals arising from the job, of course. Under another statute, one titled Traveling Expenses, Congress can appropriate up to $100,000 for the president's travels to be used in the discretion of the president and accounted for on his certificate solely. Another statute authorizes both the intriguing official entertainment expenses of the president and the somewhat boring sums for the upkeep of air conditioning, heating, and lighting at the White House, including, just to be clear, electric power and fixtures. Then there's the all-purpose assistance to the president for unanticipated needs. The money, up to $1 million, is supposed to go toward the furtherance of the national interest, security, or defense. So it's not an open-ended sort of thing, and the president must explain all such expenditures to Congress. But the presidency is about more than money, of course, even in a perk sense. Putting aside the prestige and the power, what lawyer also gets a big old historic mansion to live in for the duration of the job? Again, the law explains the precise presidential perk here. The president shall be entitled also to use of the furniture and other effects belonging to the United States and kept in the executive residence at the White House. And lest anyone get any ideas about modern plastic stuff, by statute, the White House is supposed to be a repository for the best specimens of early American furniture. Congress didn't trust the president or his family to make those calls. They're not supposed to be the judges of what's best in early American and what isn't. Instead, a committee of art historians has full power to select and pass on donated articles alleged to be the best. Furniture itself, in fact, is given perhaps the most attention in the relevant White House statutes. In addition to provenance and value, all furniture purchased for the use of the executive residence of the White House, the law mandates, shall be, as far as practicable, of domestic manufacture. And it's not up to the Obamas to keep track of all those niceties. Another statute explains that the housekeeper is responsible for all public property in the executive residence. So when President-elect Obama takes office later this month, he takes on more than what people say is the most important job in the world. He'll have a decent salary, pocket change for his travels, and a mansion to tend to, too, with all the early American trimmings. I'm Amy Gaida.
Amy Gaida is an assistant professor of journalism and law at the University of Illinois. It's 10 minutes before 3 o'clock. The New Zealand comedy band Flight of the Conchords is taking to the air once again. The HBO series about the adventures of this funny folk duo returns for a second season this Sunday. As NPR's Robert Smith reports, the goofy show is taking a slightly darker turn.
If you missed the first season of HBO's Flight of the Conchords, do not worry. The two stars can sum up a year's worth of shows in just 11 seconds.
Two guys from New Zealand come to New York, and they're a band, and they fail to...
Weekly.
They fail every week, yeah, at 10 o'clock.
You see, the band has no gigs, only one fan, and a hapless manager. And through it all, Jermaine Clement and Brett McKenzie greet their failures with awkward silence.
Stereotypical sense of humor in New Zealand is dry and understated.
Even to the point of having none at all.
We've definitely used that.
It's kind of bordering on boring. We keep it at that edge.
Which makes it all the more delightful when the boys burst into song.
And when you're on the street, depending on the street, I bet you were definitely in the top three.
The quirky musical numbers made Flight of the Conchords a cult hit. Far more people watch their video clips on YouTube than tune in for the half-hour episode on HBO. And each show brings a different parody. Jermaine trots out his Barry White moves.
You turn to me and say something sexy like,
I might go to bed, I've got work in the morning.
I know what you're trying to say, baby. You're trying to say, oh yeah, it's business time.
And then Brett brings on his rap alter ego, the Rhymenoceros.
Other rappers dismay, say my rhymes are sissy. Why
exactly?
What, why?
Be more constructive with your feedback, please. Why?
Why?
They do psychedelica, reggae, new wave, French pop.
Come on, bear. Jacques Cousteau, baguette.
And a whole riff on what it would be like if NASA launched David Bowie into space.
I'm orbiting Pluto. Drawn in by its gravitational pull. I'm jamming out with the McJaggernauts. So, and they think it's pretty cool.
While the show was on hiatus, an album by the Conchords debuted at number 3 on the Billboard chart, and the band has been selling out their tour dates, which puts a lot more pressure on the boys for their second season on HBO. How do you play convincing losers when you're already a hit? At a soundstage in Brooklyn, they're filming the last episode of season 2. It explains how the Conchords got together and their early days in America, or at least a fictionalized version of the story. Jermaine and Brett are practicing a scene about how they came up with the idea for their very first song.
Let's go to this party.
We have to finish this song, man. We don't have any songs.
You've forgotten how to rock the party.
You know who likes to rock the party.
Oh, yeah? Who likes to rock the party?
That's it, man. That's it. Who likes to rock the party?
It didn't really happen that way. During a break in the filming, Jermaine and Brett explained that they were college students and then roommates together in New Zealand.
We weren't really planning on playing to an audience. We were just messing around, mainly for our flatmates. Even they didn't like some of the songs, but we continued to play them while they were making their dinner.
All the while, the two were auditioning for acting roles on New Zealand TV and never getting the parts.
I remember a day saying, let's forget acting, let's make a band. And this is the band we made.
And then by making a band, we got a TV show.
Ironically.
Mm.
And now they joke that they're one of New Zealand's top exports after Lamb, Butter, and Lord of the Rings DVDs. Just don't expect their real-life success to spill over into the sitcom.
It seems like the second season, if anything, has some darker themes. Like perhaps by Jermaine and I living in America for a couple of years now, we've lost a little bit of our naivety.
It's almost, actually in this series, almost every episode is about losing our innocence.
Jermaine even tries to become a gigolo. Although he's so bad at it, he has to solicit his customers over the phone.
Hi, Carol, it's Jermaine here. I was just calling to say, do you remember how we slept together about 6 times, I think it was, last year in February? Yeah, I'm a prostitute now. So I was wondering if I might be able to get some money for that. Maybe about $40 a time, that's $3 off. Oh, also, Would you be interested in going out again sometime? I'd love that. Okay, bye.
In order to rescue him, Brett croons his own version of that song by the Police, Roxanne.
You don't have to be a prostitute. No, 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 no. You can say no to being a man whore, a male gigolo. You don't have to be a prostitute. No, 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 no. You can say no to being a night looker boy, hooker red boy, bo.
Flight of the Conchords Season 2 debuts on HBO this Sunday. And if you don't have cable, well, the band has learned some tricks from their online cult status. They'll now offer the show's songs for download on the internet after every episode airs. Robert Smith, NPR News, New York.
Mantras for managers. If you're the head of GM,
odds would be they bought from General Motors more than anybody else.
Or Ford's top man in the hemisphere.
We just can't be as good as a Toyota or a Honda. We have to be better.
Confident car talk at the auto show in Detroit on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 to 7 on WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from Strawberry Fields in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields Catering Department offers box lunches for professional meetings or casual lunchtime gatherings. Delivery is available at 239-5632. Strawberry Fields also offers an in-store nutritionist.
Earth and Sky.
Lori Hunter is a sociologist and population scientist at the University of Colorado. She said one in five adults is HIV positive in the rural areas of South Africa where she studies. She's researching the environmental impact of a family losing an adult member to AIDS.
We were wondering if then they're more likely to make more dietary use of local resources.
In households where a breadwinner has died from AIDS, Hunter found the family often has to rely more on the land and less on goods from the market.
One woman said to me while I was speaking with her, locusts are now our beef, which is a very clear substitution.
South African villagers already eat spinach, herbs, and insects collected locally. They also make and sell items like wooden utensils from materials found in nature. So Hunter is worried that when a breadwinner dies of AIDS, increased reliance on the surrounding environment is unsustainable.
As those kinds of resources dwindle, opportunities for the generation of those kind of livelihood strategies also dwindle.
Greater dependence on natural resources could also contribute to food insecurity throughout South Africa. Another reason, Hunter suggested, to think broadly about the impact of AIDS. I'm Deborah Bird for Earth and Sky, a clear voice for science.